Debbie Cooper, who is known professionally as Debbie Bush and keeps us posted on all sorts of medical developments, is a very busy young woman. I have a surprise for her this morning, and I cannot resist teasing her a little. We have graduated from the basement, Debbie, and we meet... We meet down the corridor in a very wonderful room on ground level. Come over. Three weeks ago this morning, knowing that in a little while you would be sitting in this room at worship, I woke up early in Colorado for a walk along the Fraser River and on up a country road, past a long valley of high mountain meadow. Sunrise and solitude are great medicine for the spirit, especially when it's Sunday morning and I'm missing the white church back home. So I stopped often to smell the crisp pine-scented air, to gaze out over the meadow, to rejoice in being alive. I watched the cattle grazing placidly on the lush pasture, bawling faintly and far away, innocent of where their lazy lives were headed. Once or twice, a mountain bluebird traced an azure streak from one bush to another. Everything was quiet and blessedly peaceful. The sun rising behind me, snow-capped peaks in front, a little singing trout stream off to the right. I took long, deep breaths, exulted in the solitude, and more than anything else, simply listened. I noticed that the sun was casting my own long shadow down into the valley as if I were 100 feet tall. I thought about how long the snow-capped hills had watched over that place without change, and how the moment I turned to walk away, my shadow would vanish. And I played the usual mind games about the brevity of human life and how fleetingly we intrude upon the world around us. When I mentioned these things later to the family, I left out the mystical parts and said something about the massive weight of those huge ramparts of granite. And we all wondered how much force it takes to thrust up that much mass. And is it still growing? And what did the first man say who saw it? To which one member of the family instantly replied, "Could have been a woman." In which case, I said, she probably used an Indian tongue to describe the mountain as sacred, as the dwelling place of a great God who speaks in thunder. It would be the most natural thing in the world to do, because the mountain dominates everything. A God with an all-season thatch of white hair and storms that seem to come right off the top of it, with flashes of lightning and deep thunder rolling across the valley. No wonder so many primitive religions have their gods dwelling on the top of a Mount Sinai or a Mount Olympus. We heard the thunder several times, some of it close enough to make us jump. But on the morning I'm remembering, 3 weeks ago this day, the sky was clear and cloudless. And instead of the noise of the mountain God, I heard only the stillness. And since I have to make something from that kind of religious experience, just as much as from the kind that comes through reading or from being with people, I decided that as August fades out and summer begins to die, I'd like to say something to you under the title, Thunder in the Mountain, Silence in the Soul. Since this is not a travelogue, but a sermon, I hope you've now made a connection between my opening words and that strange text which Debbie read to you a little while ago. It came from the first book of Kings in what we call the Old Testament. And it really makes full sense only when you read it in a larger context. So I invite you to listen for a moment now to some background. The cast of characters is especially colorful. There is Elijah, one of the most celebrated prophets of Hebrew history. Prophets are always a pain in the neck, and Elijah is no exception. He disturbs the peace. He asks awkward questions. He makes trouble, especially for those who are fat and sassy and misbehaving in the chairs of prestige and power. There is a queen named Jezebel, so conspicuous for her wickedness that her name is still a synonym for great evil. And there is a king named Ahab who is so corrupt that the Bible says he did more to provoke the Lord to wrath than all the kings of Israel before him. They all meet in our story. King Ahab peering into the prophet's face and asking, "Is that you, the one who is forever disturbing the peace?" To which Elijah replies crustily and without much imagination, "You're the one who disturbs the peace, and God's peace to boot." This kind of friendly dialogue leads them into a great confrontation up on the top of Mount Carmel, a ridge above the Mediterranean Sea, where hundreds of false prophets supported by Ahab and Jezebel face off against lonely Elijah, the hero of our story. It's one of the most dramatic of all the Hebrew tales, and you can be sure they worked it over many times through the centuries before it took the form it now has in our Bible, where it is generously touched with hyperbole, with fierce debate and savage humor, with a storm rocking across the Mediterranean Sea, and the good guy winning spectacularly, as of course he would in such a story. Jezebel, painted, scowling Jezebel, doesn't like it. And when Elijah learns that she plans to kill him within the next 24 hours, he loses his nerve and runs for his life. Now, if you listen to things critically, or if you read that way, you should be asking right now, why would a man who had just performed some of the most stupendous miracles ever recorded worry about a mere mortal, even a queen? If he can call on God, as he had just done, as the story is constructed, to flash lightning and to bring up a huge storm on demand, why wouldn't he assume that this same God will protect him from Jezebel? And the answer may be that the stunning miracles are part of the decoration of the story, while the fear and the running away may be a great deal closer to the literal truth. The Bible has an odd mix of these things. And one of the great challenges for a serious student is disentangling the one from the other. Well, that's not our job right now because we're not in class and we're not in seminary. All we need to care about is that Elijah runs, frets to God that he may as well be dead already, and ends up finally at Mount Sinai, where he finds a cave and drops off to sleep from sheer exhaustion. Mount Sinai, where according to the ancient Jewish story, God shook the hills, hurled bolts of lightning, and bespoke his power in great booming peals of thunder. And this is where the language suddenly shifts from prose into poetry. We are told that the Hebrew God Yahweh passes by Elijah in that place, and a great and strong wind splits the hills and breaks the rocks, but that the Lord is not in that wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord is not in the earthquake either. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord is not in the fire, not in any of the spectacularly great forces of nature. And then, in one of the most surprising lines in the Bible, certainly one of the most haunting, we read that after storm and quake and fire, there comes a still, small voice. Or as a recent version puts it, a sound of a gentle stillness. And it is in that silence, as Elijah listens, that he hears the voice of God. Now, all by itself, this peculiar passage leaves us puzzled. We need to know a lot of other things to know what this thing means. Let me help a little by giving you a sample of the older way of looking at God. In my distress, the writer of the 18th Psalm says, I called upon the Lord. He heard my voice, and then the earth reeled and rocked. The foundation of the hills shook and trembled. Smoke went up from his nostrils. He thundered in the heavens. He flashed forth lightning. You can read exactly the same things about the old storm god of Israel in the 29th Psalm, in the 68th, in the prophecy by Habakkuk, in the 5th chapter of the book of Judges. So in our story of Elijah in the cave, near Mount Sinai, we are surrounded by symbolism familiar to his contemporaries. Earthquakes, fire, the crash of thunder, all ways of trying to express the inexpressible power of God. And then, against all expectation, there is that astonishing final symbol. To a frightened man hiding in a cave, desperately wanting the God of power, there comes instead the sound of silence, of a gentle stillness. No one can be absolutely positive why the unknown author of this story chose to frame it in that surprising way, but it may be that this is one of those rare peak moments in Revelation, a moment that marks an advance in our notion of God as one who speaks to us within the framework of a quiet ordinary human experience from the God of bright arrows and peals of loud thunder to the God who speaks so softly within our own hearts that unless we learn to enter the stillness and listen with care, we will not hear him. The key element in spiritual discipline has always been listening. Noise and busyness are enemies of the spirit. The faster we go, the harder we work, the more noise we tolerate in daily life, the less we are able to hear the still, small voice. Show me someone who cannot sit in a silent house without turning on the TV, and I'll show you a person who has locked out the wisdom that comes from solitude. Times come when, in the words of Job, we need to lay a hand over our mouths. We need, as my mother used to say, to be shushed at times. That often takes sickness or helplessness in a hospital bed, or the loneliness after someone has left us, or a walk in the mountains. I've always thought it was interesting that we take courses in college in speaking, but not in listening. Speech 101, never listening 101. More people than ever know how to speak. Fewer than ever know how to listen. How does God speak through the sound of a gentle stillness to people who have forgotten how to hear anything that is quiet? My wife had a trick when she was teaching school. If you want to get the kids to listen, she said, you start to whisper. It's so strange, it startles them. Once we cultivate the art of listening, we hear things others miss. I read about a Kansas farm boy who was visiting his friend in New York City. They were walking near Times Square one day when the farm boy suddenly said, I hear a cricket. His city friend said what I would have said, you're crazy. It's the noon rush hour, and in all this racket you hear a cricket? Come on, get real, man. No, I really did hear a cricket, the visitor insisted, and focusing intently, he walked to a nearby corner, found a shrub in a large cement planter, dug down under the cover mulch, and found a cricket. When his friend couldn't believe what he had seen, the farm boy said, my ears are no different than yours. It all depends on what you've learned to listen for. Here, let me show you. He reached into his pants pocket, pulled out a handful of change, and dropped the coins on the sidewalk. And at the sound of the money hitting the pavement, every head within half a block turned. See what I mean? The boy said as he picked up what was left of his money. It all depends on what you are tuned into. We meet people who hardly seem ever to have listened, even to their own hearts, who make no time for thoughts to come together and make sense, who are friends with everybody but themselves. We shouldn't look for a word from God only when we are frightened or angry or in search of answers. Be still, he said a long time ago, and know that I am God. Be still and listen, and your friends will be more and more surprised at how you get along so well in this noisy world. But don't try to explain it. just say,